I met her in El Paso. She's the daughter of a retired sergeant major. And, you know, she never had a desire for law enforcement. And being around me and then going to these Halloween parties and 70s costume parties, she's like, wow, the camaraderie in the law enforcement yeah. world is awesome. And what really pushed her over the edge was when we were in Hawaii, Steve, and I took her up in the Honolulu PD helicopter, and she got to fly with HPD, and she had that experience of flying in that helicopter with the doors off, and she came down and landed, and then she started talking about going to the Honolulu Police Academy, which she did. She was 7 years as a police officer.
Good for her.
Yeah. And she's a great detective now. And
hey, everybody. Welcome back to this week's episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. I'm your host, Murph. Thanking you so much for coming back every week. You folks, you have become so loyal to this show. I just can't tell you how much I appreciate that. I look at the numbers weekly and I see the numbers growing. That means that I must be bringing on some people here that y'all like to hear, because I know it's not this redneck hillbilly you like to listen to. You know, most of you think I have a funny accent. The truth is, y'all have the funny accents, but that's why we get along, right? So seriously, all joking aside, I couldn't do this without you. So thank you for coming back. If you're listening to this and you haven't checked out Game of Crimes on YouTube yet, do me a favor, go over, type in Game of Crimes podcast in the search bar at the top. The show will pop up. Hit that subscribe button. Watch a few episodes. Hit the like button. Send me your comments. Nice comments are preferred, but I'll read the ugly ones too. I probably won't get a response though. But just come on over and support us that way. I'd really appreciate it. So this week's guest is another law enforcement professional, a legend within the Drug Enforcement Administration, a fellow Southerner, a boy that grew up in Tennessee. And you guys know that I grew up in Tennessee, and then I went to high school and college in West Virginia. That's where the redneck hillbilly thing comes from. We're going to talk about his college football career, because I'm kind of impressed by that. And then we're going to get into his 28-year law enforcement career, but he hasn't stopped yet. He's still going, maybe not as a sworn law enforcement officer, but we'll talk about that. We're going to go through his whole career. But ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Randy Wagner. Randy, brother, thank you so much for coming on the show.
No, thank you, Steve. It's a privilege and an honor to be joining you this morning. And wow, you said a couple words there, a legend. I don't know about that. Like my wife says, I'm a legend in my own mind. And I think there's some truth to that. She always keeps me on my toes. But no, good morning to you and your listeners. And like I said, thanks for having me on today.
That's a pleasure, Randy. I think either we're married to sisters or something, because that's exactly what my wife says. And then, you know, after Narcos came out and the speaking tour that we do and all that stuff, she's like, hey, Hollywood, take a trash out. And by the way, grass needs to be cut.
Yep, I'm with you.
Oh, she's very good at keeping us grounded.
You know what? I'm sorry, Steve. You're cutting grass and taking the trash out. I'm picking up dogs in the backyard. So I think you got a little bit better than I do.
Who ever thought we would be taking our dogs out and picking up after them?
My boys, when they were younger, you know, you try to teach them, hey, hard work and so forth. So they were on dog duty when they were younger. And now when they come home from college a visit, they're like, Dad, that was my, you know, that was my teenage years. You can't do that anymore. So you need to get out there and do it. So I'm like, okay, I guess you're right. So,
hey, let me know. You know what I tell my sons is you might be a whole lot younger than me. I'm an old man now, but I'll still whip your butt.
Yeah. It's funny you said that, because I wish I could say that. My father could, but I got two big boys. I think they can take me. Yeah. I really do.
Well, that's why the good Lord made sticks.
That's true. I would not go down without a fight, though. I promise you that.
There you go. I'm sure you wouldn't. But we want to get back into the small town police blotters, and Randy's agreed to do that this week. Just some funny stories about stupid criminals out there. Just to put the little disclaimer out there, this is a show about crime. We talk about bad people. We talk about bad people doing bad things to good people. Now, we take our stories very seriously here, but we never want to miss an opportunity to have a little laugh at the expense of people who chose criminality and probably should have found a different career path because they really do some stupid things. So, Randy, if you would, he's got one from California. That's where he's located. If you will, take it away, brother.
I appreciate it. I love this one. I can relate to this one, unfortunately. So a grown man traveling with a cow pajama onesie could and should be considered odd. Federal prosecutors say the situation was actually criminal, okay, among many things. The subject, Raj Matharu of Northridge, California, was arrested at LAX as he attempted to fly to Sydney, Australia, with two checked bags. Okay, no big deal there, right? X-ray screening of those bags turned up an anomaly that spurred a secondary inspection. So per DOJ press release, inside were white or light-colored clothing items, including that onesie, which I'm sure we all have at some point, as well as towels, a sweater, and eight pairs of women's underwear, among other things. Okay, and this was a male subject. Okay. That were dried, stiff, and covered in a white residue, which could lead off into several different other areas. We won't go there. We'll keep it clean.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so that testing showed the white residue to be methamphetamine. Oh. So reports indicate the methamphetamine-soaked clothing weighed 71.5 pounds. Wow. So the subject, Matharu, was intercepted on the jet bridge and later arrested. Homeland Security Investigations agent Megan Palmer wrote in her affidavit, "I believe in this instance, the white methamphetamine was washed into the white clothing and left to dry. Based on my training and experience, I know that over time in a room temperature or cold environment, the solution would evaporate and then the powdered methamphetamine would separate from the shirt, forming a white residue." The subject, Matharu, 31, has been charged with one count of possession with intent to distribute methamphetamine. If convicted, and he pled, by the way, just recently, he faces a maximum sentence of life. He's free on $10,000 bond in the meantime. I tell you what, I don't know about you, but I was never educated in evaporation and solutions and things like that. I didn't do good in math and science, but hopefully that's something they're teaching now to get that white powder off clothing. And wow, that's pretty, I got to give them credit. It's pretty genius way of trying to smuggle drugs through LAX. I'll give them that.
Well, you know, and there's a couple things I want to point out. One is there at the end, he's facing potential life in prison, but they let him out on a $10,000 bond.
Right. Hey, Steve, welcome to California.
Okay? I know, brother.
Welcome to California.
I've got a lot of friends that are in law enforcement out there, especially in Southern California. They all say the same thing.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Now, the other thing is, and you're new to the show, so you probably don't know this. We have one rule here on Game of Crimes, and that's kids don't do freaking meth.
Exactly.
Among
other things, yes. And, you know, it's funny you said that, and I'm sure we'll talk about this later on as well. But, you know, in California, you know, fentanyl is king, unfortunately. But a lot of law enforcement agencies now, the uptick in methamphetamine seizures is really starting to almost take over the meth seizures and might have by this point. So it's definitely, you know, it's a drug that's always been there, but it looks like it's starting to creep its ugly head back up even more so now.
Unbelievable, isn't it? Unbelievable.
Yeah, and I did some research on that, Steve, and Matharu, the subject, he pled guilty, and he was awaiting sentencing, and I think he got sentenced not too long ago, or actually the sentencing date's coming up. I'm losing track of time. I think October 25th, so I'll keep an eye on that one for you.
Oh, sweet, man. And there you go, going the extra mile.
That's exactly. DEA right there. I love it. Yep.
All right. So I live, all our regular listeners know I live down in Florida, and we have no shortage of stupid criminals in our state. And this one, so we're recording this on October 13th. It's not coming out for a few weeks after that, but this happened just 5 days ago over on the west side in Polk County, Florida, where our favorite sheriff, Grady Judd, is in charge over there. That man takes no prisoners. I love the guy. If you've never heard of Grady Judd, Google him and Google Grady Judd. It's J-U-D-D sayings. He's got his own list of sayings, the stuff he comes out with, and they are hilarious. They make you fall out of your chair. But so on October 8th, while being booked into a Florida County lockup on drug and trespassing charges, Walter Freimeyer passed through an X-ray machine that jailers use to thwart attempts at smuggling and contraband. But while Freimeyer, 51 years old, was not found to have stashed weapons or narcotics on his person, he was still packing something. So when he went through the body scanner, corrections workers spotted a full-size thermos inside the detainee's body. And we're talking, I saw the X-ray picture. We're talking one of those, like, what, 8-inch thermos?
Like a Yeti?
Yeah, it was the picture I saw said thermos on it, but I think that might have just been a shop, you know, a regular picture.
Oh, okay.
But sadly, police records do not include the manufacturer dimensions of the thermos, which entered Freimeyer's body a day earlier via, quote, the exit ramp, according to Polk County Sheriff Grady Judd. Freimeyer, who has a sprawling criminal record, was busted Saturday evening for trespassing on Amtrak property in Winter Haven. A frisk turned up a glass pipe with a burned residue consistent with meth. Again, don't do meth, kids. That's according to the police affidavit. And noted that Freimeyer reportedly admitted to using meth for the past 28 years.
Wow.
How is the man still alive? So while being transported, you know, so all this isn't enough. While being transported to the jail, Freimeyer allegedly warned the officer, "If you arrest me, I will find you and I'll kill you." Well, he was told that it's illegal to make such a threat. Freimeyer, he says, he replied, "Good, I'm going to kill you. So charge it." Now, he's locked up on a $12,000 bond on two felony charges and two misdemeanor charges. The thermos was removed from Freimeyer's rectum at a local hospital. He was not charged with seeking to smuggle a prohibited item into the jail.
You can't make this up.
You're not kidding, man. It's just outrageous what people will do.
Unbelievable.
So anyway, we like to start off with a laugh because some of the things we talk about get a little serious here. But thanks for playing along with this, Randy.
Oh, it's always good to get a good laugh. And I'm very familiar with the Polk County Sheriff. He's awesome. And correct me if I'm wrong. Isn't he the one that he told protesters and others that if you harm my deputy, if you take a shot at my deputy, we'll kill you graveyard dead?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And then he also made a statement that if you shoot at my deputies, we will shoot back. We'll shoot you. We'll shoot a lot. We'll shoot you so much that you'll be able to read a newspaper through your body.
Oh, my gosh.
He's got some crazy sayings out there.
I love it. Hey, they, you know, his constituents obviously love it because he's in office. It's elected position. So I wish, you know, Steve, if we had more politicians and law enforcement officials, you know, I hate to say this, but if they talked a little bit more aggressive, they might be able to quell a lot of these things that ramp up in their jurisdictions and so forth. But go ahead and letting people know ahead of time, like, you know, no messing around. You know, if you mess with us, don't bring a knife to a gunfight, so to speak, you know?
That's exactly right. I mean, we see that we see what's happening to some of these drug smuggling boats coming out of Venezuela right now. And I'll just be real honest. I'm not disappointed by that at all.
Not at all. Hey, they've been designated as FTOs and we're attacking them just like any other FTO. And as you know, you've been doing this. You've been in this business a lot longer than I have. I mean, it's about time, you know, and imagine if we had that kind of heavy hand, you know, several decades ago, what would have happened, you know?
Exactly. I've said this quite a bit. I get asked to speak on Fox and Newsmax, some of the different TV channels. And, you know, they ask me what my opinion is about certain things. Well, first of all, that term that we use, war on drugs, is probably the biggest misnomer that the government's ever come up with because it's never been a true war. Although now, you know, we're starting to see some changes.
Yep.
So we'll see what happens. You know, we'll see what happens. And then, and for those of you, you know, here on the show, I try to stay apolitical. But if you don't know, I have a Patreon channel. It's patreon.com/gameofcrimes where I get a little more in the weeds, I guess would be a nice way to say that about different topics. And that's one of them. So now, if you're wondering how Randy and I met, we had a guest on here back in September, episode 213, David Tyree. If you remember him, I got a ton of great comments about David's interview, especially with his financial background. He talked about things that, like you, Randy, it's a challenge to balance the checkbook. But I love these younger guys who are just smart as a tack, you know, and they've got this stuff down. And he's continuing to use that throughout his career. So that's outstanding. But as we were talking, he's telling me, you know, there's a guy you need to talk to. And originally he thought you were from Tennessee and West Virginia, which that's what I am. And I thought, well, crap, we're probably related. So I thought, well, how can I not have this guy on? But then when I started finding out about all his adventures, which you're going to find out about in this episode, you're going to see why he's on the show today. So, David, thank you very much for the recommendation, brother, and keep doing what you're doing out there. I know you're traveling around the world, teaching others about how to conduct financial investigations legally, you know. And what I love about it is, if you want to hurt somebody, you put them in jail. But if you want to make them cry, take their stuff, because that's why they're in the business to start with. It's all about the, you know, who's got the most toys at the end when you die. Okay, enough of Murph pontificating there. Let's get into Randy's story. So, Randy, if you would, tell us where you grew up, what your family dynamics are, brothers and sisters. What mom and dad do? I know you went to college, if you played sports in high school. Let's talk about all that stuff.
Okay. Thanks, Steve. I'm pretty sure after having our conversation a couple of weeks ago, we're definitely not related. I was actually born in New Jersey. And when people from New Jersey hear me speak now, they're like, oh, there's no way in hell you're from New Jersey. I'm like, well, I was born there and I didn't get the soprano accent or anything like that. My father hated the winters back east, and he moved us to Nashville, Tennessee. So I grew up there, not too far from where you were, you know, in Murfreesboro, where you spent some time. Great place.
Next county down.
Exactly. Yep. And went to high school in Nashville, Tennessee, and grew up a University of Alabama football fan. And Bear Bryant was one of those people that I just really looked up to when I was younger. I wanted to play for him, and loved going to an Alabama game once a year. My dad would take me. We were fortunate enough to go to Bear Bryant's last game in Memphis, Tennessee for the Liberty Bowl.
Wow.
And my dad actually scored tickets for that. And then unfortunately, Bear Bryant passed away a couple weeks after that. And he always said that if I stopped coaching, I'd croak within a week. Well, he was only off by a couple weeks. So you talk about somebody that was dedicated to, you know, building and mentoring young men and other coaches, a phenomenal person. And so finished up high school in Nashville, and I had a couple scholarship offers for football for some smaller schools, but I got an invitation to walk on at University of Alabama. And that was Ray Perkins last year before he went to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. So walked on as an undersized linebacker, and a couple weeks in, I was in a scrimmage game and tore up my ankle. So I was out on crutches for about 4 or 5 weeks. So that year sort of got derailed. And then I came back my sophomore year, which was Bill Curry's first year. And it just wasn't the same. You know, it didn't feel the same. The coaching staff was a little bit different and everything. And on top of all that, Steve, my grades were terrible. I think I had a 1.8 GPA. And at that time, I realized – yeah, it's, you know, I'm not going to be in the NFL, and, you know, this isn't for me anymore. I sort of lost my love for it, which I still regret to this day. You know, this, my only regret in life is quitting playing football, you know. So, but if that's the only regret I have in my life, I guess I'm doing good. And,
absolutely.
So, but, you know, honestly, Steve, the, Bill Curry brought in an FBI agent who, talked to the team about gambling and drug use and so forth and the dangers. And I remember talking to him in the hallway before he left. And I said, sir, I appreciate your presentation today. And I go, I want to be a federal agent when I graduate college, you know, and, you know, notwithstanding the 1.8 GPA, but, He said, well, where do you live, son? And I said, in Atlanta. You know, my mom and dad had moved to outside of Atlanta my freshman year at Alabama. And he goes, what I suggest is you go back and you get on with a local police department and work a couple of years and then apply to be a federal agent. And that was great advice. So I graduated at University of Alabama in 1991, went back and enrolled in graduate school. And got hired with the Atlanta Police Department, the only department that I put in for, because I wanted to run and gun. And, you know, Atlanta's a big city, a lot going on. And I love the time that I worked there. It really helped me prepare for my time in DEA. I was a cop there for 5.5 years, worked the worst neighborhoods of Atlanta. And I really felt like that helped me become a better DEA agent down the road as well. Worked during the 96 Olympic bombing. I heard it go off. I wasn't on scene. And, you know, that was my first real taste of terrorism right there when that happened. So I got hired with DEA in 1998. Went to
Quantico. Right, before we go down the DEA route, yeah. I want to back up just real quick and ask you questions. How come you weren't a University of Tennessee fan?
Oh, my gosh. That's a great question. I hated UT.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah, Steve. I still hate University of Tennessee. I got tired of hearing Rocky Top. I got tired of Go Big Orange. And to this day, most of my best friends that I graduated with went to University of Tennessee. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there was that stretch under Nick Saban where we were just beating them crazy every year. I want to, you know, after the Peyton Manning years and so forth, it was like 15 straight games. And then finally they won that one game a couple years ago up in Knoxville, 52-49. So I would never send them text messages or call them and, you know, let them know how bad we beat them. But, you know, for whatever reason, they get that one game in Knoxville, they tear the goalpost down. And all of a sudden my phone with text messages is just going off the hook, you know?
Yep.
And I'm like, really? So that's why I didn't go to University of Tennessee. That's why I dislike University of Tennessee. And, you know, honestly, Steve, everybody's like, oh, you know, Auburn. I really don't, you know, other than my years in Tuscaloosa, I didn't spend any time in Alabama. So my rivals were University of Tennessee. And then obviously my time in Atlanta, like University of Georgia now is like my other rival besides Tennessee, the two states that I lived in, you know, outside of going to school at Alabama. So, yeah, I don't like the color orange. I don't like anything about it. So,
all right. And then I only got one thing to say about all of that. Go Dogs.
Okay. Well, you're sort of, but you love Saban though, right?
I did. I did. I've told this story before on the show here, but you know, he's originally from West Virginia. So yep. We got the hillbilly connection, but when I was an ASAC in Atlanta, we had the OSDEF strike force. I was the ops manager over that. And a captain from one of the counties on the south side of Atlanta, fantastic guy, Mike Pruitt, loved the guy to death. I mean, I could call that guy at 3 a.m. and he'd have his troops out at 3:30 a.m., just whatever you need. Well, he ended up contracting cancer, and it got to the point where he's in a wheelchair. And, of course, we rigged his wheelchair up with a flashing blue light and sheriff's department stickers and a little siren on there and everything. But Mike, who never has nobody affiliated with the University of Alabama, never lived in Alabama, is the biggest Tide fan I've ever seen in my life. You go into his captain's office, he had one wall of police stuff and then three walls of University of Alabama stuff. It was just unbelievable. So he, you know, his cancer was terminal. So one of my guys, one of my GS group supervisors, was a former Alabama trooper. And he made some phone calls. And we got a trip lined up for Mike to go to the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa. I couldn't go, so they loaded him up in a van, took him over there, got up to the coaching offices, and the assistant coaches are like, you can't talk to Coach Saban. We're in the middle of recruiting season. You know, you're going to have to leave. It doesn't matter what anybody said. And so the guys, you know, they were disappointed, but they said, well, you know, we'll walk around the campus and you can look around and stuff like that. We'll go to the bookstore and get some paraphernalia. Well, Saban found out about it, and they said he shot through the roof. Wow. He came and found them on the campus, apologized to them, and he spent the next like 3 hours, took him back up in the offices, showed them their trophies, showed them the rings. I mean, and you know, the recruiting, you've been there, the recruiting office, that's restricted, hallowed ground in a championship football office. Just treated him like one of his own, took him out to the football field, wheeled him out in his wheelchair on the 50-yard line. Just when they left, they said the van was crammed full of University of Alabama paraphernalia from the football team, helmets and jerseys and, I mean, just anything you can think of. And I thought at that point, as long as Saban's the coach at Alabama, I am a Roll Tide fan. And I still kind of like him, even though he's gone now. But and we understand why he left, because of the, you know, the portal and the all the crap that's going on with all this stuff.
No doubt.
But I know that, sorry for y'all that have heard this story before, but I do like Nick Saban. So he's terrible on making commercials.
Yeah, he's not a great actor. And but you know, obviously the ones that he does with Dion, you know, Dion's taking the show. Yeah. Dion is, you know, prime time and so forth. But let me back you up on the University of Georgia stuff a little bit. You know, I respect University of Georgia. Vince Dooley, we're going mm-hmm. back, you know, Herschel Walker, when I grew up watching football, in my opinion, he was the best college football player ever to play. And, you know, I love Kirby Smart. You know, obviously he was tutored under and learned a lot under Nick Saban. So, mm-hmm. I don't, you know, I'll be honest with you. I love beating Georgia. But if Georgia's playing for the national championship, I do root for them. If they're, you know, as long as they're not playing us. And honestly, too, Steve, we got their number right now anyway, so it doesn't really matter, you know. but I can back you up, you know. And you just said it with Captain Pruitt. I mean, you know, there's people out there that we come across, and I've got a story regarding that as well. My father passed away from cancer 4 mm-hmm. years ago. And one of his caretakers was a University of Georgia graduate. And she's like, Randy, why don't you call over to the athletic office? And, you know, because my dad was a huge Alabama fan as well. Loved Saban, loved Bear Bryant, old school. And she's like, why don't you call over there and see if you could get Coach Saban to send something to your dad? I'm like, Stephanie, they're, you know, I'm not going to bother doing that because it's not going to happen, you know? So my mom and dad's caretaker, she was a bulldog at heart. No, you know, no pun intended. Right. She actually reached out, and a couple weeks later, this big box of University of Alabama bling, and then more importantly, a signed photograph of Coach Saban, addressed to my father, you know, best wishes and get well soon.
Wow.
Yeah. So, he's an incredible person. I know everybody doesn't like him, and I tell people, just like Tom Brady, you don't like him because he's successful, right?
Yep, that's exactly right.
It is. And Saban says this, and it's so true that, you know, average people don't like high performing people. And high performing people don't like average people. And it's true, you know, yep. It's very true. So, you know, I wish I had his energy at his age. Yeah. I mean, to coach at that level. And like you said, with NIL, the portal, all these different things coming into play, and to still maintain the success that we had at Alabama was pretty incredible.
Yep. Yeah. And, you know, be nice to have his money too.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt.
Highest paid college football coach in the league.
Exactly.
Ultimate respect for the man.
No doubt. Yeah. And so I went to University of Alabama and got hired with DEA in 1998. So I did 5.5 years with Atlanta PD. And then laying in my bed in Quantico, I laid in bed there the day I got my assignment going, who the blank did I piss off to get sent to El Paso, Texas?
Now, okay, so what class were you in? What's your BA in the back?
Oh, my God, 122.
122?
Yeah, I had to think about that one for a minute.
You didn't know there was going to be a test today, did you?
I know, I didn't. I had to think about that one for a minute.
And when you guys went through, when did you find out where you're going to go, and did you get to submit a wish list?
Great question. We didn't find out. Steve, I want to say it was maybe 3 weeks before graduation.
That's where we were.
Yeah. And, you know, the wish list, some people got their wish list. I didn't, you know, and maybe I made the mistake of putting on my, you know, application that I was a Spanish speaker, and only because I took 2 years in high school and 2 years in college. I don't know if that had anything to do with that or not, but I couldn't speak a lick of Spanish at all, at all. I knew what chingate meant, and that was it. That's all I knew. So, to your point, I was laying there going, man, I wonder if Atlanta PD will take me back. I wonder if I can go get a good job as a barista at Starbucks. But I was disappointed in El Paso. But you know what, Steve? Honestly, I told myself, God is my witness, that I just wanted to get hired with DEA. I wanted to get hired. And yeah. I told myself I would go wherever they sent me. And boy, I was held to my word. And but that was a great place to work. It really was.
You know, I've heard horrible things about El Paso my entire career until I got promoted up to SES, and then went down there. I probably ended up making 8 or 10 trips there in the last few years of my career with DEA. And I don't know that it'd be my favorite place to live, but everybody I met there was nice. The food was outstanding. Everybody had the hospitality was like being in the South. Uh-huh. You know, there was the chief of police for the University of Texas, El Paso, UTEP. He found out that was my first trip. And he's like, well, come on, I'll take you on a tour of the border. And we hopped in his cruiser, man. And he showed me all around. He showed me bullet holes in the side of the campus buildings where stray rounds from across the border come across into the U.S. and hit the buildings up there. Luckily, nobody was hit, but I ended up liking the place. I don't know that I'd enjoy living there, but I'm sure it's a lot nicer than what we're all led to believe, you know, throughout our careers.
Yeah, no doubt. And I can tell you everything you just said, I agree with you. You've been around the planet. The Mexican food in El Paso is the best anywhere I've had. And I live in California now, not even close. When I went into Mexico a couple of times, the food in El Paso was better than anywhere I'd been. Yeah. And, you know, El Paso grows on you. It really does. The people are phenomenal. And I was there in 98. I was there during, 9/11. And when we would have, you know, this was in our younger years, we would have Halloween parties. We would have 70s costume parties at me and my friend's house, who was a customs canine at the time. And when you came to our house, whether you were dressed up in Halloween garb or 70s garb, you never knew what agency anybody else worked for, because we were so tight. And I'm dating myself now, Steve. It was customs, right? It was Border Patrol, all these guys, FBI, El Paso PD. And it was just a great time. And it was a family environment in El Paso. It really was. That's and the casework. Yeah. The casework was just, I mean, come on, you know, incredible. I mean, you know, driving across to our Juarez office to meet with them to talk about cases and an armored vehicle and so forth. And just a really great experience, you know. And you know, it's, you know, a lot of movies have been made, you know, regarding the border and so forth. And, you know, it's got an eerie, you know, kind of sense to it as well, where, you know, you're out in the middle of the desert, you know, and you drive in either direction and there's nothing but desert. So, you know, they always talk about, you know, no telling how many people are buried out in the desert in Las Vegas. I feel the same way, unfortunately, about El Paso, you know.
I think you're right about that. Were you, when you went through the academy, were you already married?
No, I was single at the time. And I think that helps out a lot. I worked with a lot of folks that were married before going into the academy. And, you know, then they go out and they get a place like El Paso, you know, or San Ysidro or Brownsville. And the spouse is like, well, wait a minute, I didn't sign up for this, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I really think that helped me to adjust to El Paso, because I was by myself. I was single. And then, you know, you don't have to worry about, your spouse or a family because, hey, I'm here to concentrate on the work, which was great. I went to the mobile enforcement team, did that for about a year and a half. So, you know, was traveling up into like small. At that time, we had the state of New Mexico too, in El Paso, part of the field division. So we were doing cases in Portales, New Mexico, Las Vegas, New Mexico. There actually is a Las Vegas, New Mexico, believe it or not. And if you saw Red Dawn, the original one with, that was actually filmed up close to Las Vegas, New Mexico. And, you know, Patrick Swayze and those guys were so enamored by the beauty up there. Patrick Swayze brought property up there, and so did Val Kilmer as well, although he wasn't in that movie, but beautiful.
Is that close to an area called Ruidoso?
No, Ruidoso is actually close to El Paso. It's about 2-hour drive east of El Paso into New Mexico mountains, which are beautiful. And Steve, it's crazy, but you can go skiing up there. They get snow. And Ruidoso is a place that I met my wife in El Paso. So we were actually going up to Ruidoso and Cloudcroft, which is another like winter retreat in the New Mexico area. But it was actually southern New Mexico. When you think of, you know, New Mexico too, you've got Taos and some of those northern towns and cities in New Mexico. But yeah, Cloudcroft and Ruidoso were southern New Mexico.
Were you, you had mentioned in our conversation a couple weeks ago about a case in New Mexico involving, it's an airport case.
Yeah. When was that? I want to say it was early 90. No, it's actually 2000 or so when I just come out of the Met team. I went from the Met team, for those your listeners that don't know what the Met stands for, it's a mobile enforcement team. But you basically go around to your AOR and you help out smaller jurisdictions that have a drug problem. And, you know, we went to Portales, New Mexico. We actually helped Dallas Division out by going to El Reno, Oklahoma. And then we did Portales, New Mexico, too, when I was there. But after doing 2 years on the Met team, the El Paso management staff wanted a stronger personality at the airport task force group that was attached to the El Paso International Airport. And, you know, we did a lot of, you know, in El Paso, it's dope going out and money coming back in. So we were doing a lot of, you know, consensual encounters at the airport and so forth, and worked with some really great task force officers in that group at El Paso PD. And, you know, would also work like the freight companies, FedEx and UPS, you know, running dogs in the back on packages and so forth, and then doing surveillance and knocking those packages out and doing controlled deliveries. But honestly, Steve, I sort of got burned out doing that. And I wanted to go fish in another pond. And there's a town called Santa Teresa, New Mexico, which is to the west of El Paso off of I-10. And I remember driving out there one day to go. They have a really good air museum, believe it or not, situated really close to the Santa Teresa airport. So I went out there and I'm like, wow, this airport is out here in the middle of nowhere. I wonder if any law enforcement is looking at anything going on here, because, again, it's just a hop, skip and a jump across the border. So I went to I talked to one of my partners at the airport group. He was actually a customs agent at the time. And I'm like, hey, man, let's go one day after work and let's go see if we can find the airport manager at the airport in Santa Teresa. So he's like, okay, let's go. So, you know, we go over there, you know, trying to dress down a little bit, not looking like DEA agents, which we really had to do a really good job in El Paso. But we did surveillance on the tower, Steve. And, you know, it was a clue, you know, with my University of Alabama education, it was a clue that the gentleman locking the door at the tower was the airport manager. So I went over there and actually showed my badge to him and introduced myself. And I asked these words strictly. This was strictly this one sentence. do you see anything suspicious out here? And I'll never forget his one sentence answer. It's about time someone blanking came to talk to me. Wow. So I'm like, okay, well, we're here now. We talked to him a little bit longer. And what was awesome was he lifted his keys up and said, hell, I'll let you see it for yourself. So he actually gave us the spare set of keys to the tower. Ooh. And it, you know, you take it, you look at it and you take it like, this is a cry for help. You know, this guy mm-hmm. wants to get law enforcement involved. So, we took those keys and we went back and talked to our GS at the time and told him what we want to do. Hey, we want to go out and do some surveillance on Santa Teresa Airport. We talked to the manager. He gave us the keys to the building and so forth. And GS was like, of course, go for it. So, you know, we would get there at twilight when, you know, the sun's going down and so forth. And, you know, discreetly walk into the tower, unlock it. So, you know, we got the keys, so it doesn't look like it's law enforcement there. So we would sit in the tower from about 8 o'clock at night, and we would get out before all the maintenance folks would come and things like that, about 6 o'clock in the morning. And Steve, this was old school, and, you know, I consider myself old school, but we just took down tail numbers of the aircraft that were landing at Santa Teresa Airport. And we took down tail numbers for 2 or 3 days, ran them through the El Paso Intelligence Center, which does not get utilized enough. Right, Steve? It does not. And I can talk about that later as well. Epic was actually had a big part. They did some filming at Epic in the movie Traffic as well.
Right.
So, but I ran those tail numbers through Epic and then ran them through FAA as well. An old colleague of mine, Jack Vandenberg, who worked at Epic, was assigned there with FAA. And then I got all the NATIS hits back and all the database hits back through FAA and everything. And we actually hit into one of the largest cocaine DTOs at that time in Juarez, which was the Zaragoza Fuentes family, and made an OCDEF case out of it. And I love OCDEF. Unfortunately, it's going to be a thing of the past here. It is with the takeover of the Homeland Security Task Forces. So made an OCDEF case out of this and actually went back to El Paso and went to Epic over the summer. And somebody heard me talking about that at Epic. And they actually said, they called me over and looked at the screen. And that case to this day is still being worked on, but different splinters from that, case as well.
Holy cow.
So it's a lesson learned that I'm trying to teach some of the folks that are new to law enforcement as far as cultivating confidential sources and cultivating information. You know, a lot of times you don't have to sign these folks up. I preach to everybody every day. There's people out there, no matter what happened in the last couple of years, there's people out there that really want to help law enforcement do our job, you know? And a lot of times, Steve, you know this, that they just might've made a mistake in their life or they didn't catch a break, that, you know, couldn't get them into a law enforcement position or so forth, but, you know, they want to help law enforcement. And I do, I see that turning a lot right now, based off, you know, the last couple of years of the protests with George Floyd and things like that. So I think we're headed in the right direction now with support for law enforcement and so forth. And you can see the numbers now picking up in the academies and so forth as well.
You know, the academy brings Javier and I up there twice a year to speak to the trainees going through. And we were there earlier this year, and I checked in with our point of contact up there just a couple of weeks ago. We're coming back at the end of the year, and he said, you know, we've only got two small classes in right now. They're having a hard time filling the classes. So, and with the budget, the continuing resolution, you know, not to go off on a political tangent, but I can't help it. I'd like to see everybody in Congress fired right now because you and I and the whole world knows at the end of September, 100 years from now, you need to have a budget in place. And
yeah.
The people that, and you know, they've closed down the government, although Congress still gets their paychecks.
Right.
So that's a whole nother topic.
I'm with you, and that's not apolitical or political. Why not have term limits on Congress? You know, and you've got, and I'm speaking on both sides. You've got folks that are in their 80s in Congress, and it's like they're so out of touch. And you know this, congressional staffers that are 55, 60 years younger than them are out there gathering the information for them. And, you know, it's very disheartening. So, and I hope that we are turning the corner here in California. Just so everybody knows that I am not a Californian. Obviously, I'm an East Coast guy like you. It's just turned out to be some opportunities for my wife and I, who's actually in law enforcement as well. But, you know, here I teach at one of the academies locally, and I do see the numbers starting to pop up a little bit more, which is encouraging. But on the flip side of that coin, Steve, you know, I hope that they're not just getting people in to get people in. And, you know, when you and I
don't reduce the standards.
Exactly. And I unfortunately, Steve, I do think that's happening in a lot of states. I'm not in the recruiting process here in California. I hope that's not happening here. But, you know, I remember the days, you know, when you and I were getting hired with DEA. I mean, I remember my background investigator going to talk to every single neighbor I had in the last 10 years. And, you know, people are getting jobs now where I'm not sure if they're doing that. You know, it's not as labor intensive. And you remember this. I remember them saying when I was getting ready to get hired with DEA that we only hire 10% of the applicants, you know, and you know, I'm wondering how much, if that percentage has gone up, you know, I'd be curious about that.
Yeah. I will say this, the basic agent of trainees that we meet when we go up there and speak, they're all studs and studettes. I mean, they are impressive people. Whether you see them in the gym working out, or you see them sitting in the classroom paying attention, or even coming and listening to us do our little presentation, it's just it's very heartening to see that. You know, it makes you feel like, hey, DEA does have a future here. So
no doubt,
real impressed with the people going through. But back to your case there and at the airport, that's old school policing right there. That's taking the time to go out to get away from behind your desk, because we, you know, you and I have seen later in our careers how some of the new guys are coming in and they want to make cases on computers. They don't want to go out in the field. Well, you got to go out in the field. You got to be able to describe a residence in an affidavit. You got to be able to describe all your activities. You got to corroborate the things that you're finding on the computer. And then you go do your surveillance to see who they're meeting with. I mean, you know, it's just the whole point of saying all that is to commend you for taking the initiative to go out and talk to that airport manager, which turned into a gold mine.
It did. And I, you know, one of the things, too, I think that is a detriment during COVID and when people were not signing up to be law enforcement officers and so forth is we forgot how to talk to people. Right. This generation has really forgotten to talk to people because, like you said, everything's technology. And to your point, I used to hear all the time, oh, well, I got a tracker on Murph's vehicle, or I got a tracker on Wagner's vehicle. I'm like, well, that's great. But how do you know who's driving the vehicle? Yeah. How do you know how many people are in that vehicle if you're not out there with an eye on it? And I really am passionate about confidential sources. They help me make a lot of great cases. And again, they're not the do all, but like you said, you want them to corroborate information that you have. You might want them to make buys that, you know, in organizations that you can't get law enforcement into. And then, hey, when it's run its course, that's great. Now I can go up on a Title III case. So I'm passionate about this. I've been asked and I'm currently doing it for the Northern California HIDA and the Central Valley HIDA. I have a confidential source class that really, you know, I'm trying to educate any law enforcement officer, whether they're fairly new or not, because we tend to get into this mindset of flipping a defendant. Okay.
Right.
And I'll give you a perfect example. I don't have the numbers for every state. I don't have the numbers for your state. But in California, criminal justice reform organizations say that one person in every five California residents, one in five, Steve, have a criminal record. So that means at one time they were arrested. So one in five. Okay. Like I said, I'm terrible at math. My checkbook proves that. But one in five means 20%.
Right.
Okay. So the rest of that, four out of five is 80%. We're not talking to that 80% of the population that's out there for information. So what are we missing? And the airport manager at Santa Teresa Airport wasn't working off of beef, right? The former spouse of one of our largest marijuana traffickers in the state of Hawaii, she wasn't working off of beef. She just wanted to do her ex-husband, which was great, right? And, you know, the U-Haul rental facilities, the rental car facilities, the RV parks, you know, no one's getting out there and talking to these people. And I know that, Steve, because for my class, you know, I want to make sure I know what I'm talking about. When I ask them the same thing I asked the Santa Teresa airport manager was, does anybody come in and check in on you? And do you have anything that looks suspicious? And it's amazing how many people want to talk to law enforcement about, yes, I am seeing this, you know, utility workers, you know, gas and power utility, you know, imagine what they're seeing with indoor grows and things like that. So, I'm really trying to educate law enforcement on, like you said, getting off your ass, taking the initiative. And you know, back in the day, I remember being a duty agent in El Paso and watching, literally having to walk around someone watering the plants in the El Paso field division as a duty agent. But you know what, Steve, when that phone rang, when I was duty agent, I took it serious. It wasn't just maybe somebody calling in some bull. A lot of times it led to some really good leads and, you know, a good confidential source or two.
Yeah. And that's, for those of you that are listening, that are not in law enforcement, when you're dealing with these informants, one of the things you really have to do right at the beginning is determine what is their motivation for wanting to be an informant. Are they just a law abiding concerned citizen, or like the one wanted to do her ex-husband? Is it one drug trafficker wanting to take out another drug trafficker? Is it a drug dealer who's trying to pull the wool over law enforcement's eyes? Yeah, there's a lot of different motivators out there, but that you have to determine at the beginning. And like we used to do in Miami, if we had, which it was rare to have a down day where you out were not already obligated on surveillances, either on your cases or somebody else's case, but we would go do surveillance on our informants. That way we could go back to the court and they say, how reliable is your informant? Well, on these days we surveilled the informant and didn't see any legal activity. We talked to him and asked him where he was, and his answers were correct. And, you know, there's a lot of different little things. I don't want to give up all our little means and methods of trying to keep our informant straight, but you got to get out of the office to do that. You know, and you talked about putting the tracker on the car. Well, that's great. It's going to show you on your computer where the tracker's going if it's still attached to the car, but it doesn't tell you a thing about who the driver of that car is or who they're meeting. Exactly. And that's what you want to know. That's the purpose of doing that.
Yeah. And I've seen it too. And you said it as well, that like just basic surveillance techniques are not like they used to be as well. And the desire to get out and do surveillance. I love doing surveillance. And, you know, I remember being in, working those cases in New Mexico where we were actually going to the rental car company and switching out our vehicles every week. Yep. You know, because we were deployed up in these places for 10 days at a time, but the case would take, you know, 4 to 5 months. So we would work 10 days and go back to El Paso for four, but we were constantly changing out our vehicles because we didn't want to get made. And, you know, it's different times now. Like I said, worked a couple wire cases in my time, but I always loved getting out there and, you know, putting the Exxon, you know, worker shirt on, or putting the utility company shirt on, you know, putting the placard on the side of the van, you know, Connie's carpet cleaning service, and then just, you know, having that camera running, you know?
Yep. That's true.
I don't hear law enforcement talking about that as much as I used to, you know?
Right. So how long were you stationed in El Paso? How many years?
Oh, 5 years. Five great years. I did. I met my wife there, and her father retired from White Sands Missile Range, and great time in El Paso.
Yep. And then did you want to leave, or were you promoted? You ended up in a pretty nice spot next.
Yeah, well, remember that conversation I had with myself laying in bed in Quantico? Who the hell did I piss off to get sent to El Paso? But yeah. The law enforcement gods and, looked out for me. And I got a position in Honolulu at the district office there. And, after 5 years, I loved moving around. I think that's what DEA does really good, better than any other agency, is they move us around, because we're one trick ponies, Title 21, right? So it's important. Yeah. And you took advantage of that too. So it was just time for a change. And I've been to Hawaii a couple times, and it doesn't get much better than Hawaii. And, wow. And the great thing is I went into the position as the DCEP coordinator, which is Domestic Cannabis Eradication and Suppression Program. And basically, for the novice ear, it's marijuana eradication. And, I was in helicopters all the time. It bothered me to do this, Steve, but I had to go to Kauai and Maui and, spend several nights in those, islands that, were just downright, wasn't very nice to be in, but,
just rub it in. Just go ahead and rub it in.
Yeah. And, but what a great position I had there. And really, as a DEA agent, really got to work with, the state and locals in Hawaii. Hawaii mm-hmm. County PD, Kauai PD, Department of Land and Natural Resources, Honolulu PD. We worked as one team, and it was awesome. Everybody would travel to the islands and help everybody out on the marijuana eradication missions and so forth. And, when I got over there, I still wanted to work cases. I loved running the program. I was in charge of a $4 million budget I wasn't even a supervisor, right? And so it was just great being in a big task force, like a state task force. And but I would split some, a couple from the herd that really wanted to work on cases. So I ended up doing two big OCDEF investigations during my time in that position, one in Hawaii County PD with Hawaii County PD. I don't know if you ever, I know you're familiar with High Times magazine, but there was a gentleman called Roger Christie, who was the marijuana minister. And he actually, I'm not making this up. He believed that marijuana was a sacrament, a religious sacrament, and therefore you could ingest marijuana because it was a sacrament of God. And we had a really good Hawaii County cultivated a really good CS, and I worked with him as well. We signed him up on our side as well. And you talk about what the motivations are for some of these CSs, and he was a marijuana smoker himself, user himself, but he was pissed off that Roger Christie was manipulating people for $100 to get a piece of paper that said you are now a member of the marijuana ministry, therefore you were immune from prosecution. I'm not making this up, Steve. And that pissed the CS off. And so he wanted to go after Roger Christie, and what better way to have a motivation in a case and revenge with a CS. And we worked it up, and he introduced me a couple times, and I purchased, a little bit here and there from him just to get going. And then at some point, Roger thought I maybe was in law enforcement because I didn't want to give him 10 grand to help build a new warehouse to start growing some other of his marijuana in, other than the people that he was manipulating in the grow for him. So, right. But as we hit that dead end spot, and it gave us a necessity to go up on a T3, which we did. And arrested 13 people all over Hawaii County for. And it was a really cool case, and flew all 13 defendants back in a Coast Guard C-130 from Hawaii County to Honolulu federal detention, which was awesome. And again,
oh yeah,
I can't tell you how many different agencies we had. You know, you think of Hawaii and it's islands, and it is, but we had every federal agency and every state and local agency assist in that case too, which was really good. So, yeah.
Well, that guy, I'm not sure what book he read that in, but I've read the Bible and I haven't seen anything in there where it talks about weed.
No, I haven't either.
But you know, I love the fact too, that you're talking about the cooperation between agencies, and it was the same in Miami, although we used to battle regularly with customs. There was a lot of competition there, and we even found a customs river group that we could work with, and we did successfully. It was phenomenal, the loads we were bringing in back that time. But it was, I'm like you, I can't, you know, you were Atlanta PD, but it's still Southern. I mean, it's a huge PD. I'm from a small PD in West Virginia that only had a 35-man department. But you get to Miami and you find out you've got access to Coast Guard aircraft or Navy ships will you can change Navy ships directions to come and support you in your cases. It was just phenomenal. And I'm thinking, I had no idea that DEA had this kind of sway with the Department of Defense to get military vessels and aircraft changed to do what you wanted to do. That's how you fight the enemy.
Exactly. It's awesome. And you're talking, you know, you're bringing up military. They're always there to support missions. And, you know, we had that in the Middle East as well. And even in Hawaii, when I worked in Hawaii, we would load up our DEA helicopter, and the National Guard, the Hawaii National Guard counter drug, would bring their helicopter as well. And we would fly to Guam and Saipan. And you're sitting there asking me, well, your helicopters can't make it to Guam and Saipan from Hawaii. No, we had the relationships with the Guard to where they would get a C-17 out of California to fly over. We would load up the helicopters in the C-17 and fly them to Guam and Saipan and do marijuana eradication missions in Guam and Saipan as well. So from local law enforcement all the way up to the U.S. military, it's truly a team effort. And, it's unlike anywhere else in the world where we have that collaboration among all these different agencies and so forth. And really, Steve, we talk about our local police department backgrounds. I only wanted to go DEA. And that was because when DEA came to talk to Atlanta PD about something, they brought us in as part of the team, you know. Yeah. And that, I remembered that. And I think that's why a lot of folks that I actually worked with in Atlanta PD went on to DEA as well, because they saw that kind of collaboration and felt like, you know, hey, this is a federal agency that's not here to take over. They're here to help us out as well.
Yeah, we got along great. I was stationed in Atlanta twice. Loved Atlanta PD. Dedicated. The thing I hated was that the rookie officers coming out of the academy qualified for food stamps because the pay scale was so low.
Oh yeah.
Hated that part of it. But then, yeah. I mean, you look out at Gwinnett County, mm-hmm. you know, highest paid agency in the Metro Atlanta area. They used to be, I'm sure they probably still are. And that was a fantastic department as well.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I remember what my salary was when I started, and I had the 4-year degree. So I think my salary in Atlanta PD with a 4-year degree, my starting salary was $22,000 a year. But I know you know this, Steve. We were also called entrepreneurs, right?
Yeah.
You know, I think Atlanta PD coined the term moonlighting, where we were always working nightclubs, we were working construction sites, and I know a lot of officers that actually doubled and tripled their salaries because of all the time they put in it. And I wanted to work and make money, but at the same time, I didn't want to burn out just to make a lot of extra money. And during the 96 Olympics, we made a lot of money doing moonlighting jobs and so forth, because there's a lot of bars and restaurants that were open 24 hours a day during the Olympics, believe it or not. So it was, that was a great time too. So everybody's making money, including Atlanta police officers, finally.
Yep. Yep. And legally.
Legally. So, yes.
There you go. So how long did you stay in Hawaii?
I was there for 8 years.
Okay. And then did you want to come out, or you what was next in your career?
Yes. Yeah, so after the DCEP position, the marijuana eradication coordinator position, I promoted into a task force there, a HIDA task force. And my wife was actually Honolulu PD at the time as well. And if you've been to Hawaii, 8 years is a long time. I started getting island fever and so forth. So it was time, you know. So I promoted to the resident agent in charge of the Santa Rosa office, which is conveniently located in wine country. And didn't have to sell my wife on doing a lateral move to wine country. And she was fortunate enough to get a lateral position with the Santa Rosa Police Department, where she's currently a detective right now.
Wow. Now, you met her in El Paso, right?
I met her in El Paso. She's a daughter of a retired sergeant major. And, this is a great story, too. She never had a desire for law enforcement. And being around me, meeting me, and then going to these Halloween parties and 70s costume parties, she's like, wow, the camaraderie in the law enforcement world is awesome. And what really pushed her over the edge was when we were in Hawaii, Steve, and I took her up in the Honolulu PD helicopter. And I didn't take her up. Obviously I'm not a helicopter pilot, but she got to fly with HPD, and we fly with the doors off in Hawaii. Yeah. And it's different when you fly with the doors off than with you flying them with them on. And she had that experience of flying in that helicopter with the doors off, and she came down and landed, and then she started talking about going to the Honolulu Police Academy, which she did. And she was a police officer there for going on what now? She was 7 years as a police officer.
Good for her.
Yeah. And she's a great detective now. And like I said, I like to think that I had some influence on her with, but again, it was all the people that she was around in this community that we have in law enforcement.
And that's, a lot of our listeners hear me talk about the law enforcement family all the time. And that's the worst thing about retirement is not having that camaraderie. But if you get off your lazy butt, we come to Orlando. Our youngest daughter and her family lived here, were the only people we knew in Orlando. We moved here 4 years ago. And we weren't here long at all until her husband got a new job up in Atlanta. So the reason we moved here to Orlando now lives in Atlanta.
Right.
But through just going and talking to people, I've got a ton of cop friends here now. I've gotten to speak at the Orlando Police Foundation annual gala. There's cops at the gym I go to every day. It's, and not to say that we don't have other friends, because in law enforcement, that's common.
Yeah,
we're a tight knit community where we don't allow other people in sometimes. But so anyway, we've been going here for a little while. So we want to call it quit to today's interview, but we're going to bring Randy back tomorrow because we want to get into what he did up in Santa Rosa. And then we're going to talk about his overseas career, which is impressive. It's we might even end up in Afghanistan talking a little bit about not heroin, not opium, but another drug. So, Randy, thank you so much for being with us today. And I'm telling everybody, you're going to be back tomorrow. I'm hoping you'll agree to that.
I'll be here with bells and whistles on, Steve.
You got to love it, right?
Yep.
And for all you listeners, thank you again for joining us here. You're just getting started on this story with Randy Wagner. Please come back tomorrow. Until then, God bless. Everybody stay safe out there.